Music is a part of life for everyone on the planet, regardless of their income, race or creed. It bonds us, soothes us and nurtures us. But it can do so much more. In fact, there's a whole new science called music therapy. So if it's therapeutic, is all music good or is some detrimental? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. And welcome to Go Healthy for Good. In 1993, researchers made the surprising discovery that listening to Mozart's Sonata for Two Pianos, K448, for 10 minutes resulted in a significant improvement in mental function. Others noted a reduction in seizures in children with certain types of epilepsy, and this was coined the Mozart effect. Concert pianist Erwin Nanasi is going to play for us the first movement in Mozart's Piano Sonata No. 16 in C major, K545. Enjoy. On today's show, we're going to see a different side to one of our favourite guests, Dr. Neil Nedley, as he talks about the influence of music. We'll put together an interesting dish in the kitchen, and Sean will be here to improve our fitness. But first, the news. In the headlines today, music favourites for dementia, Mozart for men, and music's answer to cardiovascular disease. An iPod loaded with a playlist of their favourite music may be effective medicine for people with dementia, according to a recent study called Music and Memory. 13,000 people with dementia living in 98 different nursing homes were provided with an iPod, which staff loaded with music tailored to their tastes and memories. A control group of about 13,000 people with dementia in another 98 nursing homes were also followed for comparison. Behaviour problems, depressed mood, and the use of anti-anxiety and antipsychotic medications was assessed before and at the end of the 6-month study. The music and memory nursing homes had a drop in dementia-related behaviour problems and the use of anti-anxiety and antipsychotic medications. In the standard care nursing homes, behaviour problems and antipsychotic use was unchanged, and fewer patients stopped anti-anxiety medications. The intervention was not costly, yet seemed to make a difference to quality of life. And in case you lose your marbles, be sure your family and friends know your favourite music titles. Classical music may enhance performance for men focused on a task. Researchers from Imperial College London and the Royal College of Music asked 350 visitors to a science festival to play the board game called Operation, which involves removing body parts from a pretend patient with tweezers while not touching the sides of the body. the volunteers wore headphones that played one of three tracks: classical music by Mozart, rock music by AC/DC, or the sound of an operating room. Those listening to rock music were slower and averaged 36 mistakes. The other two groups averaged just 28 mistakes. AC/DC impaired function for men, but not for women, who tended to be slower than men and made fewer mistakes. Researchers postulate that loud or discordant music causes more auditory stress in men. So if your surgeon's a man, you can ask him to listen to Mozart while he works on you. The music of Mozart and Strauss can lower blood pressure and slow heart rate, according to a recent study. German researchers assigned 60 people to listen to music for 25 minutes. They were divided into three groups: Mozart, Johann Strauss Jr., or the pop band ABBA. Another 60 people, as the control group, spent their time in silence. Before and after the experiment, blood pressure and heart rate were recorded, and blood was taken to measure the stress hormone cortisol. There was a mild drop in blood pressure among those resting in silence, a marked drop in blood pressure for those listening to classical music, and no change while listening to ABBA. All three music groups had a measurable drop in cortisol levels, though it dropped more for men than for women, especially while listening to the music of Mozart and Strauss. For those with hypertension or stress, there's a novel remedy for you. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Our guest today is Dr. Neil Nedley, an internal medicine physician and founder of the Depression Recovery Program. Music is an important part of the program, and to understand why, here he shares the musical legacy handed down to him from his father.
My father was a naturally gifted musician. He was, of course, educated some, but then did a lot of his own self-education, including music theory. And so he was able to compose, arrange, it was actually skilled, more skilled in doing so as a result of being in the Navy. He was a Navy officer, and you'd be on board ship in World War II, and there'd be not much happening, you know, for a couple of weeks going across oceans and things. And they always wanted entertainment, and so the people that had instruments on board, he would compose for everybody, and it would be the evening entertainment in the arrangements and all of that. He did mention to me the first time he did that, he didn't realize that, you know, a trumpet was like B flat, and a piano was, you know, he played the piano, and it was C, so he wrote it all in the same key, and then when they started playing, it was just totally discordant, and he had to stop and figure out what went wrong, because it should have all been great, and then he realized, oh, wait a minute, the clarinet is a different key, and the trumpet is, so he had to learn to write in all the different keys that way, too.
Wow, so he became very skilled.
He did. Yeah.
And so he left the Navy, and did music become his profession, or?
Well, he made his way through college as a paid musician. He would work in nightclubs and continue to compose and arrange for jazz orchestras. And so his primary way of making money was playing in bars and nightclubs in the evenings, became quite popular.
With all those skills, I'm sure he did. And jazz being a very technically difficult style,
yes,
of music.
Yeah, more technically difficult.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. So obviously, there's music in your genes. And and you've handed that down to your boys, but we'll come to that. Where did his music take him?
Well, interestingly, after he started having children, he decided that he wanted to give them something that he didn't really have, and he knew he needed to get it first. So he decided he wanted to learn about the Bible and religion and things. And so he was trying out different churches every weekend, every Sunday, he'd look at the papers, and he was trying to find a church that would teach him the Bible. And a lot of the churches would say, you don't want to get really too close to that, you know, it may set you off in the wrong direction. And so he would rule them out and keep going. And finally, he found a church that really was interested in the Bible, but they worshiped on the wrong day. And he thought they were a little confused and didn't know the Bible that well until he began to study that out and realized the seventh day actually is not Sunday, which he had assumed all of his life. And then he had to make some decisions because he was working and studying. He was getting his master's in engineering at this point. But he recognized that the music that he played and loved, the effects on people were not the best as far as spiritual effects. And he noticed it always tended to produce downward movement in morals instead of upward movement in morals. And he just knew that, you know, this is not the type of music that's best if I really want to connect with God and have an awe-inspiring relationship with Him and to be able to instruct my kids to go this direction as well.
Which a young father must consider. Now, think about this.
Hey, why didn't you join me and sing with me?
Well, I was waiting for you to hit the right note, but you didn't.
Yeah, well, I know I'm pretty bad. You know, even though I don't have perfect pitch, I really do enjoy playing the guitar and singing.
You shouldn't worry about the perfect pitch. You know, music is about expressing yourself and enjoyment. Do you know it's linked to cognitive improvement? And for little ones, they improve their language development, and it's good for social interaction.
You know, in parts of the brain, the two halves function separately. The left brain is analytical and the right brain is artistic. Performing or listening to music impacts both the brain as a whole. Therefore, it stimulates both halves.
Yeah, and I guess maybe Einstein's mother knew that, because when she was told that Albert was not very bright, she enrolled him in violin lessons, and pretty soon she had a genius on her hands. And you know, it just a really beautiful example of how a child's intellectual capacity can be opened up by music.
So is all music good for you?
Well, that's a whole different topic, but let's just say for now that the music that you're playing and singing is good for you.
You know, even though I'm out of tune, do you mind if I go ahead and play and sing?
I think you should. Doctor's orders.
Thank you, Doc.
When it comes to vegetables, we don't think about legumes as being a veggie, but they are one of the most important vegetables. So we're going to bring you a salad made with legumes today. And Phil, tell us what we're making.
Well, I love this salad because it's great side, but it's also not full of greens. Just in case you think of greens when you think of a salad, which most of us do, this kind of throws that out. So it's a brand new type of salad.
Fantastic.
So this is our white bean salad. And this has 1 can of cannellini beans, 1/4 cup of diced red pepper, 2 tablespoons of flaxseed oil, 1 tablespoon of minced shallots, 1 tablespoon of fresh lemon juice, 2 tablespoons of chopped parsley, and 1 tablespoon of fresh oregano.
So
it has a lot
great.
Of fresh ingredients, which are going to be terrific.
Yeah.
So I'll start this. If you could start by cutting up our shallot. And I like to mix the liquids together. So I'm going to start with our oil.
And that's loaded with omega-3 fats, flaxseed oil, so it's the perfect oil for a salad dressing. And we often forget about it. And then all the fresh herbs, it's going to be full of antioxidants. Some lemon juice, some red pepper, vitamin C. I'm thinking vitamin C, yummy.
Now, I like to get the liquids first, and then I can kind of mix them up on its own before I throw any ingredients in. So I've done just that. I squeezed in the lemon, I got the oil. Now I'm gonna throw in our beans. And I like to rinse and then drain the beans whenever I deal with canned beans. If you're not gonna do that, at least get like the lower sodium beans, because you can buy canned beans that have lots of sodium in it.
Right.
And you don't need it.
And I see you got the salt-free beans this time, so well done, well done. Apparently 70% of the salt we eat comes out of things like that. Let's see if I can make some of that go in the bowl.
The important thing is we're having fun here.
Oh, yeah. And we don't have to clean the studio afterwards.
Right? So I'm absolutely. So I am dicing this red pepper, and I'm going to throw that in there.
This oregano smells good.
That's one thing I love about fresh herbs. It just, it makes the food in the kitchen smell great. It adds a whole bunch of great color in addition to great taste. So
and
I love cooking like this.
Very, very healthy. They've got more antioxidants per square inch than most other foods that we eat. So it's a great way to boost the antioxidants in a meal.
So the more you can get into a meal, the better, then,
it sounds. That's right. Yep. Well, the more that we think to add them to our food, the better. Coming over. I'm having too much fun here.
All right, so I've cut this up. And this has some amazing color, which I just love.
Yeah.
Especially with a salad. It's going to make it look so much nicer on the side of the plate. It'll be more enticing for all of your guests or your family. And you're getting extra vitamins, extra nutritional value from the different ingredients.
We could call it an Italian salad.
We could.
Red, green, and white. Isn't that the color of
the white bean Italian salad.
Okay, I think I went a bit heavy on the parsley, but hey.
Well, with cooking, especially with something like this, you can make it to your own tastes. We don't have any science that's going to need to bake into it or anything like that.
That's
so
true.
You can make it to your taste, and this is a beautiful salad. Now, with something like this, I like to let it set. So it's a good idea at least 30 minutes in the refrigerator just to set aside. I even love to maybe overnight. That way the flavors just really kind of get in there and get together. But if you need it at a quick moment's notice.
Because you're on TV.
Then you've got it right here. And that is a beautiful salad.
Oh, wow. That looks gorgeous. Looking forward to this. That's really good. That all those herbs, you can't taste anything else.
I love the herbs. Like that just gives it such a great taste.
It does, because if you're not a keen fan of legumes, this is a great way to hide it. And because diabetics should be getting legumes every day. But if you're not a fan, this is a great way to introduce it. Thanks, Phil. For that recipe and all our other recipes, please go to our website, hopetv.org/gohealthy. We're talking about music therapy today and enjoying the treatment of musical performances by Erwin Nanasi. Watch as he plays a contemplative piece by Frédéric Chopin, Prelude in E minor. That is very different to the jazz that Dr. Natalie's father performed during his professional career. Now he was a young father, he began searching for a connection with God. He realized the jazz music that he loved so well seemed to influence others into moral decline, and personally he felt it draw him away from God. What was going on? Dr. Nedley explains.
Well, as it turned out, his love of jazz, you know, it was part of his life, you know, and you know, he made his money this way and he was quite popular this way, but his love of jazz, he realizes now on this side that it became an addiction. And so whenever jazz was being played, he would want it and he would have a sense that this is me, I need to get close to this. But yet he knew it wasn't good for his brain. And so he had to make a decision that I've got to stay away from this. It's like alcohol for me. And so to become an ex-alcoholic, you have to not just slow down in your drinking, you have to quit altogether. And I didn't quite understand that when I was growing up. I was the last child. But I would notice that whenever even a commercial came on the radio and it had some jazz in it or rock or whatever, he would, boom, he would turn that off immediately. It was still in that process of conscious, you know, to be consciously competent. In this. So in other words, he was still having to utilize some persistence in this. Now, after I started to get a little older, I realized he had totally overcome the addiction. Because now, at this point, he could even, for demonstration purposes, play hymns in a jazzy format and then play it in a nice arrangement format where it would be frontal lobe enhancing. So he began to do music seminars. And if he listened to jazz, it didn't have that attraction anymore. The good music had the wonderful attraction. And it's one of the reasons why he took us every year to the University of Michigan for Handel's Messiah. You know, he loved that music as well. And so I grew up every year hearing a live performance of Handel's Messiah with a 300 voice orchestra. And
I
grew up.
I still remember hearing that when I was eight, but I've not been back to hear
it. Oh, is that
right?
Yeah,
I
mean, I could do it. So if anybody did mess up, which hardly ever happened, we would know it because I knew it that well.
Wow.
And so I grew up in quite a different music environment than what he grew up in, but it was really enhancing for me, and I really appreciate the fact that my frontal lobe had advantages that maybe his didn't at first. But fortunately, he was able to change that brain into something that was a transformed brain as a result of the musical choices he was making.
So a couple of things came out of that. One was this principle of replacement, that he didn't just remove the music from his life, but he replaced the jazz for a superior choice of music.
Correct.
And it was interesting that he could tell. Nobody had to tell him about the jazz.
Yeah.
He sensed that something was wrong with it.
Yeah, and he tells me that most of the musicians that are in this field are pretty well aware of their effects. He says you can see it. You can see it every night. You can see it on the faces of the people. You can see it in regards to what's happening and how, you know, romances start to develop over this music where it's not wise romances at all and those sorts of things. And so
what's happening there? You're talking about sort of decision making. Is the music suppressing frontal lobe function, you know, that part of the brain? What's happening there?
Well, actually it is. There's several things about jazz that are going to have some frontal lobe suppressant effects. One is the syncopated rhythm. So you have the boom-cha, boom-cha. It's dance-type rhythms that jazz performs. And if you have that continual syncopation, if you have boom-cha for a couple of measures, it's not going to suppress your frontal lobe. But it's the continual syncopation over 90 seconds to 3 minutes where we will see people go into alpha-wave rhythm where they're in a hypnotic state.
Just like television or media can
just
do.
Like television or media can do, yeah, with a rapid scene of reference change. And then, in addition, you have the discordant harmonies. And, of course, musicians tend to, the higher you are up in music, the greater the tendency you're going to gravitate towards jazz. Because jazz has interesting harmonies. And the reason why they're so interesting is because they're discordant. And, you know, regular rock and roll, it's straight harmonies. you have the powerful syncopated rhythms underneath it. Right, but it's much more simplistic.
Okay.
Where jazz, you have all of this discord. And it turns out dissonance actually is what suppresses the frontal lobe even further. And so what you want to center in on are what's called consonant harmonies. The consonant harmonies are more of the straight harmonies. You can have some sevenths or ninths or elevenths as part of a transition, but you don't center in on that. And with jazz, it's just you're centering in on dissonance. You might even end your entire piece on a dissonant chord. And the musicians in the group say, ah, that was interesting. That was, you know, they'll kind of get a nice smile out of it. But it actually is not something that the brain gravitates to that's healthy for it.
What's unique about birdsong, musically speaking?
If you slow down every birdsong, they're actually singing in a minor key.
Fascinating stuff. Now consider this. Music is a part of celebration all over the world. We sing our national anthems, we sing happy birthday to each other, we sing in church. In the Bible, we see music used to celebrate as well. I love the story in 2 Chronicles 20, where Israel's enemies, the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Edomites, combine forces and come for a battle against Israel. They outnumbered Israel many times over, and Israel thought it was about to be annihilated. But then God promises them victory, and they won't even need to fight. He told them to get into position, stand still, and watch him save them. King Jehoshaphat and the people bowed in humility when they heard this good news, and the choir sang loudly. The next morning, just as God told them, the king led the army out, got them in position, and then he appointed singers to sing a battle song to the Lord and to praise the beauty of holiness. Suddenly, the Ammonites and the Moabites turned on the Edomites and destroyed them, and then they turned on each other and destroyed each other. It says no one escaped. It took Israel 3 days to carry home the loot, and on the fourth day, they sang and praised God all the way back to the temple in Jerusalem. In place of anxiety and complaining, why don't we sing more? It would give God so much joy and fill us with courage, hope, and faith. We're back, and it's time to get moving. Sean is here.
Good to see you.
Good to see you. This looks good.
It does.
Weights and balls and, yeah.
So we got some dumbbells and we got resistant, the stability ball.
Yeah.
Or the Swiss ball. A great tool. And I'm going to show you just how to change or how to modify some of the traditional exercises that you typically do. Now, you may see some people go on a bench, right? And they would do a regular bench press. But how about let's try it on a stability ball today?
Ooh, sounds dangerous to me.
Let's try. Hey, no. No. We're going to err on the side of caution. Sorry. Yeah. So you want you to have a seat, feet this way.
Okay.
And I'm going to bring the weights to you. I want you to kind of roll out into that bridge position that we've done before. And what I want you to do is take your dumbbell, and I want you to press like you're doing a chest press, okay? Elbows are going to touch the ball a little bit, all the way down, and up. Good range of motion. You should feel your chest cavity expand. You should breathe. But most importantly, and this is for you out there too, is that you're working two parts of the body. You're working your entire core area in the bridge position, and then you're working your chest, okay? What you could do from that position, hold it up at the top right there, put the handles together, just like that. And what I want you to do is go all the way back. Now you should feel your rib cage and all the way back up.
Ooh, didn't we?
Again. Come up to rotate and go back. Yes. Once again, working that core area, working your chest. Now you're working a little bit of the back. This is how you burn a lot of calories during and post workout. Okay, great way to have fun.
Woo.
All right, take your time. 3, 2, and 1. Good job. I'll take it from you. So another one. Now that we've warmed up the chest, we warmed up the back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I want you to try. Now, you know you can normally do a row, right? Like this.
Right.
Okay? What I want you to do is put your hand on the ball here and then row, all right? The core has to work to keep yourself balanced. All right, you go ahead and try it. Try and push on it a little bit. Put some of your weight on it and row. Your mind is thinking, what is going on?
It sure is.
It is, right?
Yeah.
And most importantly, your core has to work. So if I were to shift your body weight onto the ball just a little bit, this is a little challenging. It is. You now have to keep your body stable and you're still working your lat. You see what's happening, right?
Yeah.
This is a great way to kind of trick the mind into
this really makes the brain work, this one.
It does. It's like chewing gum and
yeah, you know, or patting your head.
All right, switch sides, do the other side. There you go. Now, if I increase the load on in your hand so that a heavier dumbbell, it would even be more challenging.
It sure would.
Again, this is a little bit more of a way to kind of change up the normal routine, challenge your core a little bit, and you gotta have some fun, all right? And last but not least, I'll take this from you. Grab both of those weights. And what I want you to do is feet nice and wide, and I want you to take the weight, and I want you to reach down for the toe. Back to the center, and reach again. Core tight, reach. There you go. You can do this for about 20 reps. Every time you go down, that would be considered a rep. Or you could do it for about 45 seconds. You will burn tons and tons of calories. We've already worked the chest, we've worked the back. Now you're working a little bit more of your lat as well, all right?
And these are probably good exercises if you have a bad back.
Absolutely.
And you wanna really strengthen that.
Absolutely.
Back, get that core going. And relieve that pain.
Absolutely. But just be careful. You know, don't try and pick up a load that's way too heavy.
No, you're going to start with small weight.
Oh, yeah.
And build up there.
There you go. Slowly.
Great.
I'll take this from you. All right, let's stretch it out real quick. One of my favorite cool down exercises, alternate your right hand on the top, left hand on the top. You're opening up your chest cavity. You're stretching out your lat. Okay, open and close. Open and close. Shake it out a little bit, and guess what? You are done.
Whew, that's great. Thanks, Sean.
You're welcome. Good job.
Can you do anything today to prevent future bone fractures? Women were surveyed in 1976 and again 25 years later in 2001. When asked about wrist fractures and physical activity, interesting results surfaced. The women who were the most physically active in 1976 were almost 40% less likely to have a wrist fracture by 2001. Physical activity had a protective effect. Building strong bones is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time for me to answer your questions. Here's our first question. Someone texted, I read that most tofu has calcium sulfate, which is not a good form of calcium, but calcium citrate is okay. Well, tofu can be made with or without calcium sulfate, though that calcium sulfate, calcium in that particular formation, preserves the soy proteins well, and it gives it a desirable texture. Although there are different tofus with different textures, but this is a nice firm texture, and the calcium is actually absorbable. You're right, as you asked in your question, the calcium citrate is more absorbable, but you're still going to get calcium from calcium sulfate. There could be better ways to get your calcium. Most of us don't eat tofu in order to get calcium. We eat tofu because we want to enjoy a nice meal. There's a side benefit, though, that we do get calcium from it. Now, it is possible to eat too much calcium sulfate if we overeat tofu, but with the average amounts that most of us eat, your body is going to be able to metabolize that sulfate adequately, so it's okay to eat it. And here's our next question. I had moons on all my fingernails when I was young, but they are now gone. Should I be concerned? Fingernail moons actually may disappear with age. Not everybody. Some people keep their moons all of their lives. But it can also indicate anemia or malnutrition. So think about whether you've got either of those conditions. Otherwise, don't worry about it. Someone called and asked, how can you be a vegan without spending too much money? Well, you know, it's very affordable to buy whole grains and legumes in bulk. And they're a very cheap way of eating. And then add to that at least 2 servings of fruit a day, 3 servings of veggies. Again, they don't have to be the most expensive fruit and veggies in the store. They can be the cheaper ones. You can even grow a lot of veggies yourself. Green veggies are very easy to grow. And the savings that you make on better health, you can use for healthy treats. So it's overall very affordable. Now remember, if you have a question, send it in by Facebook, text, phone, or contact us on our website. Like us on Facebook to become part of our Go Healthy for Good community. And now let's see what's down at the store today. Although usually just thought of as bird seed, millet is not just to feed birds. It's been an important food staple in Asia and Africa for thousands of years, being identified in many archaeological digs. The reason for its widespread use is that it's resistant to drought and it's able to grow in semi-arid, impoverished, less fertile soil. But crop yield is best when the soil is very fertile and there's good irrigation. Millet has many different varieties, the most popular being pearl millet, which is what I have here. Other varieties include teff and sorghum, the variety determining its colour, white, grey, yellow or red. Millets are rich in B vitamins, calcium, iron, potassium, magnesium and zinc. In India, millets are milled into flour and used to make flatbread. Millet porridge is a traditional food in Russia, Germany and China. And in Russia, it's eaten sweet with milk and sugar added after cooking, or savory with meat or vegetable stews. In China, it's eaten with beans, sweet potato or squash. In Germany, it's also eaten sweet, boiled in water with apples and honey, and they're added after cooling. I enjoy it partly boiled, then baked with raisins, honey, milk and lemon rind. Bon appetit! Before the break, Dr. Nedley told us that every bird sings in a minor key. I asked him why we find birdsong uplifting, yet we think of songs in a minor key as sort of being sad songs.
Minor does not have to be sad. You know, a lot of times people think of like Tchaikovsky's last movement as Pathetique Symphony, and obviously it was depressed, but that's some of the most depressing sad music. It seems like the worst thing has probably happened to somebody in regards to that. And that's your slow minor with the slow transitions and then keep getting sadder and sadder and it keeps going down and down and deep. Where with the bird songs, even though it's minor, they're kind of going up. You know, they're having the uplifting portion of things. They're doing it fast and it's actually similar to a lot of Bach's music, where Bach loved to write in minor, but his music isn't really considered sad per se because it's very rapid, nice harmonies underneath it, it's conveying a message, and but there's more pathos associated with it. In other words, you're you're more likely to think about the music.
Ah.
Yeah, it's thought-provoking music. And so it's making you think, boy, I would like to just contemplate that. I would just like to meditate upon the music itself.
So it does something different to the brain than just depress the brain.
Exactly.
Actually stimulates thought.
It actually can stimulate thought, yeah.
Which is frontal lobe again.
Which is frontal lobe, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not a bad thing. So we don't have to have all our music in major keys.
Correct.
All right.
Yes.
Well, that's good. You know, I'm thinking about sadness and depression.
Uh-huh.
Does music have a way of causing depression? Now that we've ruled out minor keys, can music depress?
Absolutely it can, yeah.
How so? I mean, and what kind of music?
Well, it does tend to be, well, I mentioned Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, and there you have more beautiful harmonies, but again, it's decreasing and it's very slow and sad. But you can also cause depression just by listening to Prokofiev played at half speed. In fact, this is ways we induce depression in people. There are studies where we're actually wanting to induce depression to see how their mind does when they're depressed in cognitive function. And one of the standard ways of inducing depression in an individual is to play them Prokofiev at half speed.
Fascinating.
And Prokofiev is pretty angry, dissonant music. And so you have all of this dissonance, and you have this anger together, and you play it at half speed. And of course, depression is anger directed inward.
Yes.
And it happens.
Okay, so there you've got that dissonance again coming in and
that's right.
altering feelings.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, I've played piano, I play piano, and I've played, and people have come up and said, it was a joyful, it was holy, you know, the holy city,
uh-huh.
and they've come up and said, it made me cry.
Hmm.
Does music have this emotional impact? And obviously that wasn't a depression, I hope I didn't tip someone in, but mm-hmm. does it have a powerful emotive response?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Music is an emotional language. And it can definitely provoke emotions. In fact, this is one of the things that a lot of people don't understand. I often hear that, well, you know, music in this culture is going to be related to differently than music in another culture. And the evidence that that is really false reasoning is every Hollywood movie that gets translated into different cultures, they'll have different actors in that culture, they'll have different scenes. But the music score always stays the same.
Is that
because
right?
What produces sadness and crying in one culture, Chinese, will also do it in Africa, will also do it in Argentina and Mexico and the United States and in Germany.
Wow.
And so this is an emotional language that transcends any culture or language. And that's why the music scores always do stay the same. And those people that are writing the music scores, they're very aware of what emotions they're trying to provoke. They're experts at understanding music therapy and what emotion needs to go with that scene.
Now, so if music plays to the emotions, so to speak, can we use that to an advantage?
Oh, absolutely.
Or it's not always a negative thing, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. It can be used to our advantage.
So what music would be good for the emotional center,
yes.
presumably the limbic center of the brain?
Yeah, what is good is music that has beautiful melodies. It has primarily the consonant harmonies. And in addition, it has straight rhythms as opposed to the syncopated rhythm. So the primary rhythm is going to be straight. It is going to have some scenery associated with it where you can kind of imagine what the music is about. And you can almost play a scene by imagining it that goes along with it. That's an additional benefit. And yet again, there's even a greater benefit if it's reverential and awe-inspiring. Now, I'll give you an example of music that fits all of those characteristics. But for your viewers that go to Southern California, the best thing to see in Southern California does not cost a penny. It's actually to go to the largest painting of the Crucifixion of Christ. It's bigger than a football field, and most people in Southern California don't know about it. It's a tremendous painting, and it's in a mausoleum that you can go to for free. It's called Forest Lawn Glendale. It's where all of the Hollywood stars want to be buried, and of course Michael Jackson, there, and all of these big stars. So you can go visit there. Probably don't get buried there because you might break your family if you do so. But if you go to this painting, before they open the curtain, because it's a large painting, they put the lights down, they will play Handel's Largo. And it has all of the six characteristics of enhancing the frontal lobe and elevating your mood and getting your interest level up in regards to what you're about ready to see. And then when it's completely dark, after that music is played, they open it up, you still can't see it, and then they spotlight all the characters because it's not just a painting of the Crucifixion, it's every character that was there on Mount Calvary that day. And so they go through the story. The entire story is being played, and then they finally show you the entire picture.
Yeah.
And then they also play you another Handel piece. Handel actually was very good at writing music that was excellent for the brain because he was writing a lot for a depressed king, and he knew the principles of music therapy. The water music, for instance, was to get him out in nature, go down the river, and cause his depression to go away, and it worked.
Just as it worked when David played for King Saul. Stand by for more from Dr. Nedley after the break. Don't go away. Our next performance piece, played by Erwin Anasi, is J.S. Bach's Prelude in C Major. Hang on to your hat for this one. Invigorating. Have you ever noticed how easy it is to memorize words when they're set to music? I asked Dr. Nedley to explain the association between memory and music.
The musical area of the brain is the temporal lobe, which is the same lobe that houses the hippocampus. And so music and memory work very well together. And even in Bible times, they put scripture to music, and that's how they memorized all of those psalms. It was much easier that way. And it was much more than that if you know that Miriam put a lot of sections of scripture to music and made it easy for the people to remember these profound words that were being inspired by God. And so, yeah, it goes together. And that's why even, of course, unfortunately, bad music and bad words can also be memorized more easily to music as well.
Oh, yes.
And you'll see a lot of the young people lip singing and remembering all of these words that that they wouldn't necessarily be gravitated to if they had seen them on a sheet of paper. Because when you actually look at it there, it's like, whoa. Is that what I'm singing? But yeah, they can memorize some pretty bad stuff.
Yeah, that's a good point. But the Bible says we should sing hymns and psalms and spiritual songs with praise in our hearts.
So yes.
What's a hymn? What's the definition of a, you know, I know the Bible often will repeat something three times to kind of consolidate it, but is a hymn different to a song?
Well, it is, because the hymn has all of the harmonies. You know, you can have a song that's just a melody and it's just one line, where a hymn is going to virtually always be four or more part harmony. So it's actually higher end music. It's putting the harmonies with it, the rhythm there is with it, and even composers, the most difficult thing that they would compose as part of a symphony or whatever was the hymn-like section. That was in the midst of that symphony. And that always brought the most interest because it is, it's deeper. And so hymns are deeper because it's portraying music that's deep as well, spiritual songs. And it, one of the most beautiful things, of course, is this is some of the most beautiful Christian poetry ever written. But it's also put to some great music, and that's a combination that's pretty unbeatable. And unfortunately, our modern society in Christianity has somehow thought that they needed to get away from that. That's been a big mistake for them, and it actually has led people slowly out of the religious circles instead of towards them. And hymn music was primarily a Christian, biblical type of prose. Now when we start mirroring the world's techniques on worldly songs and putting that in there, it can put more of the desire of the world in our heart.
You seem to know a lot about music. What's your musical training?
Well, of course, I grew up in an environment where music was just part of our life.
Yeah.
And so I grew up, of course, playing the piano and actually had done some of my own arrangements and things like that with the help of the great music therapy mind of my father, who would help me through that process. But I also got some additional training, and then where I really learned about the effects of music and the brain chemistry aspect of things was through Dr. Juanita McElwain. She was known as the mother of music therapy. She started 6 different music therapy programs around the country, PhD music therapy programs. And the last program she started, fortunately, was closer to where I lived in Oklahoma. And once I realized she was there, I said, and she was doing all the research there, she invited me up to her lab. I got to sit in her chair and have all of this music piped in. And she would measure everything, your galvanized skin pressure, your EEG, your heart rate, all of these things. And they could be altered easily.
Wow.
By the music that was being played. And so I became fascinated with that, particularly with my interest in depression and anxiety. And so it took off from there.
So what do you use to treat your depression patients? What kind of music?
Well, we utilize a harp music, a traditional harp music, kind of, I'm sure, like David utilized, beautiful melodies, harmonies. There's some wonderful things about the harp. You can't play it too loud. If it's too loud, that can be kind of grating and can actually increase anxiety. It's not really built for syncopated rhythm, so the straight rhythms flow easily out of the harp, and that can be very healthy. We also actually have hymns. In fact, studies have shown that listening to hymns and singing hymns is a frontal lobe enhancing exercise. In fact, it's one of the best frontal lobe enhancing exercises we can do is to sing hymns. And so we'll have even atheists and agnostics, after showing them the studies and showing them why we're doing this, we'll have them participate in it. And the atheists and agnostics, they all know Christmas hymn music. And so sometimes we'll have Christmas in July so that they can utilize their voice and joining in this frontal lobe enhancing exercise. And of course, we'll use piano and other types of instruments. So there's no instrument that's out per se, other than maybe the trap drum set, because that's virtually always designed for syncopation. We can use timpani and other types of things, but there all sorts of instruments can be utilized in the right way, using the 6 principles to actually enhance the brain and pull people out of depression and anxiety.
Music preference is very personal, but we still need to consider the style of music that we listen to. As we've learned today, it can affect our mood, our morals, and our mentation. It changes our heart rate, blood pressure, and circulation. If you have children or grandchildren, help them and guide them to select music with helpful, not harmful properties. And if you experience depression or anxiety, add music therapy to your toolbox. That's all for me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.